Welcome to episode 5 of Under the Microscope,
where we take the complexities of biology and magnify them to simplicity.
I'm Daniel Hill.
And I'm Clint Bergeron.
Here we go. Oh, got it.
What is it about red eyes, sharp fangs, and sharp claws that reach into your psyche and terrorize you?
What is it about the dark that makes you check under your bed and in your closets?
Deep inside of all of us is a deep, innate fear of being eaten.
By a predator. That was creepy.
Let's start out with a little Q&A. Hey, Daniel.
Yep.
What animal are you most afraid of?
Oddly enough, I'd say an alligator.
Okay. What about second most afraid?
I would go with a shark.
And for funsies, third?
Maybe, not that this is a real danger here, but a lion?
Awesome. Yeah, I'm afraid of those three too.
In last episode, if you remember, we asked our listeners to go to speakpipe.com/UTM podcast and answer that same question. So,
what animal are you most afraid of?
Wolves.
Definitely a shark.
My biggest phobia is sharks, hands down.
Rattlesnake.
I am deathly afraid of sharks.
Huh. So, why did we ask that again?
Because, what do they all have in common? Sharp teeth, sharp claws, the urge to kill. They're all predators. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Things that kill to get their meals.
Culling the herd.
Dang, nature, you scary. Should we say that?
Too late now. Yes, this episode is all about predators, and we have a special guest. His name is Michael Modzielewski. About 15 minutes in, we talk to him. We find out what it takes to survive 18 months alone in the rugged, frigid clutches of the Alaskan Inside Passage. We chronicle his journey filled with near-death experiences, encounters with killer whales, and moments of insight and wisdom. You're not going to want to miss it. But now, we're going to go ahead and talk about our first predator, the wolf.
The coolest thing about them is they live as family units, as packs. That means they're not out there hunting deer alone, where you can get a broken leg and starve to death. They're utilizing their numbers and actually behaving in a set way. Like, every wolf in the pack has its job, and it knows its job, and it performs its job well. This is what makes these predators at the top of their game.
Right, and in these podcasts, we're beginning to see a theme where these animals are a lot more beneficial than we realize, and wolves are no different. They have a big impact on our ecosystem, and whenever their habitat is damaged, whenever these forests are cleared, whenever stuff like this happens to these wolves, that increases the chance that we are going to run into them, which is a very bad thing, and I think you know why.
Right, but it's also a very good thing to have these wolves in nature doing what they do. The reason is there have been incidents where in areas where wolves have decreased or vanished completely, deer and other herbivores have taken over to the point where the forest can't replenish itself simply because they're eating all the saplings, eating all the foliage. And when they've reintroduced wolves into these areas, not only do the deer species thrive actually because they're not being malnourished because they're going through all the food, the forest itself becomes more alive. The balance is restored, and in an ecosystem, in nature, balance is key.
Right, balance is key, and basically it's sustainability. It has to maintain itself, and it can't do that without predators. That homeostasis helps regulate the health and stability of the ecosystem.
And take Yellowstone, for example. Wolves were reintroduced in 1995 to much criticism, but the results have been really interesting.
So you're saying Yellowstone didn't have any wolves?
Yeah, for a long time, they didn't.
Wow.
It didn't, rather. But with the reintroduction of the wolves, the wolves, of course, started feeding on the elk population, which had grown out of control. And the elk were actually eating so much vegetation that it was unsustainable.
Wow.
So they couldn't support their own populations. The forest couldn't regrow. And a lot of interesting things happened when the wolves were introduced, such as the beaver made a comeback, which had become absent from the park. There were no beavers either. Wow. Because the trees couldn't grow. The elk would eat the saplings. The beavers had no trees to make dams with. Also, the red fox recovered, probably due to the wolves putting a smackdown on the coyotes.
And due to that smackdown, there were carcasses that scavengers could feed on and other organisms could feed on, which just led to more biodiversity. And biodiversity is extremely important because the more organisms that there are, the stronger, more adaptable, and more resilient the ecosystem will be. And in this case, Yellowstone has become. And now we're going to move from the wolf to a predator that's even more ferocious.
Ladybugs.
Wait. Ladybugs?
Ladybugs.
Really? That's not where I was going.
Well, we're going to stop and talk about ladybugs.
I'm disinterested.
I'll change your mind.
All right.
Vicious killers. Savage killers. The only bug you want in your garden. Handling business. Dropping aphids like nobody's business. Left and right tearing off heads. Consuming nonstop, insatiable eating machines. That's the ladybug.
I'm sold. So, a ladybug is not a bug at all.
Nah, it's a beetle.
Huh. Wait, a beetle is a bug.
Yeah, no, not a true bug. Let's not really get into that.
Okay, not a Hemiptera. Right. I know you said don't get into it, but it is of the order Coleoptera.
Okay, you happy now?
Yep.
Let's go.
These bugs are crazy.
They practice cannibalism.
They eat each other.
That's because the urge to kill is so intense. The need to feed is so strong. They don't care what it is. They don't care if it's their own brother. They're killing it and eating it.
That is crazy, like I said. Have you ever heard people saying that you can count a ladybug's age by counting the spots?
Yes.
That's stupid.
It is.
There is no truth to that.
No.
You'll be wasting your time.
Yeah.
So what else about these cold-hearted killers?
Well, they're so awesome at killing that they're used as pest control for crops and gardens, and they're very, very effective. Like I said, they're the only bug you want in your garden, because they will be the only bug in your garden, because they're going to decimate everything else.
So ladybugs go through complete metamorphosis. Have you ever seen the larva stage of a ladybug?
Yeah, I can't make sense of it.
Yeah, it's kind of awesome. I'll put a link to one on the show notes because I've actually taken a lot of pictures of them because people have no idea what they are and they look really creepy.
It's not what you'd expect, I'll tell you that.
So let's go ahead and leave the ladybugs behind as much as I've come to appreciate them because I want to talk about a predator that is doing a lot of damage, a predator that you do not want to be anywhere near, and this predator is probably in your house. Wait, what, was that a cat?
Yeah, common house cat. The most destructive predators hiding right under our noses, and most people think they're just funny internet memes or
which
cute
they are.
And cuddly,
which
I guess.
They are.
I guess. Eh, no, I don't think so.
Tasty.
I'm not going to be able to hide my disdain for cats. I'm sorry.
Well, that's okay. I'm trying to cover it up a little bit for the cat lovers.
But for all you cat lovers, I want to change your mind. Even slightly, because cats are responsible for 1.4 to 3.7 million bird kills every year and 6.9 to 20 billion mammals annually.
And they try to say that these are unowned cats, and I just did air quotes, but come on, that's your cat.
Yeah, Tinkerbell with the collar on, it doesn't matter. You're feeding her well. Doesn't matter. Cats kill apart from the drive for hunger. So they can be totally full and still have the urge to kill and go out, maim, kill a few birds every time you're letting them out.
Right. And they're labeled as the worst invasive species. And they actually say they're destroying the ecosystem. there's no balance. There's not that homeostasis whenever there is a cat involved.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. You're letting cats out to go play. They're killing, and they have no repercussion because they get to sleep in a nice, safe home where they're safe from larger predators, and nobody's coming to get them. They're perfectly safe. They're free to kill, and they come back.
And I'm not sure if you heard of this thing called
toxoplasmosis.
But I'm sure you remember it's from cats.
Yeah, and not only toxoplasmosis, these cats are killing endangered species like the piping plover.
The cardinal.
The Florida scrub jay.
The scrub jay. I wasn't expecting you to say scrub jay. What is a scrub jay?
I don't know. It's on the screen.
The scrub jay
I'll say whatever
bird.
It says. I have no morals or allegiance.
Whatever's on the teleprompter. So, now that we know that cats will kill the scrub jay, I think we should move on.
Yeah. Keep your cat inside, or get rid of your cat, or don't buy cats. That's my recommendation.
Or eat it.
Or eat it. Feed it to the gators.
Here is a segue. Let's take a look at this cold-hearted predator, the golden silk orb weaver.
Also known as a banana spider.
In addition to their normal meals, these spiders are known to catch birds, like hummingbirds and baby birds that are just learning to fly in their webs.
What? That's kind of sad.
Yeah, and when something's caught in the web, he knows the feeling of the poor little insect trying to get out. The specific vibrations tell him. And then, all of a sudden, he's paralyzed.
Wait, who's paralyzed?
Our spider. He's paralyzed, and now he's dissolving on the inside while his guts are being sucked through the straw of the assassin bug. This is just one of the deceptive tactics that the assassin bug has in its arsenal.
So the assassin bug acts like a struggling bug to kill the spider?
Yes, and then he sticks his rostrum,
its beak-like nose,
deep into the spider's body, paralyzing it with lethal poison, and literally liquefies the spider's insides and sucks it up for food.
That's intense.
Yeah, and also what's intense is they'll camouflage themselves with insect carcasses and dust.
What? Like a real sniper?
Yeah, they have all kind of assassin-like behaviors, like squeezing out toxic ant bait out of their butt, and the ant thinks it's a nice treat when all of a sudden they're paralyzed too.
But they're not dead. They're just paralyzed until the assassin liquefies their insides.
Right, and that gives the assassin bug enough time to tell the ant, hey, you just ate my poop, and now I'm gonna eat you.
Also, in the assassin bug's arsenal is a species that will cover its legs in tree sap to attract bees to kill.
They'll also jack a dead termite to attract live ones.
They can mimic a cat meow to attract cats.
Nope, they can't. Ah. But they will feed on cat blood.
And human blood.
That's true.
Yeah, they carry Chagas disease and liquefy your insides too.
And speaking of liquefying your insides, I've got a story that will make your heart melt.
What a segue.
After this break, we'll talk about an animal whose entire civilization depends on capturing just one guy.
We are 100% listener supported. All donations go directly into making more awesome content.
Show your support by going to patreon.com/UTMpodcast.
What if the survival of your entire civilization depended on the capture of one guy? Not one battalion or one regiment, just one guy.
I don't even think that's realistic. I mean, how can one individual cause the destruction of an entire civilization?
Well, you're right. It doesn't sound realistic. But what if I told you that it happens all the time?
I would need you to explain.
Sure. Well, let's take a look at a thriving civilization. A beehive in Japan.
Wait, bees? I thought you said we were talking about a civilization.
Yeah, we are. I mean, a bee colony is nothing if not civilized. Think about it. There's 100% employment, no crime, community support, no homeless problem.
Yeah, well, when you put it that way.
Yeah, it sounds like they may have a leg up on us. So let's imagine a large, efficient bee colony enjoying the fruits of its labor. The workers leave the hive every day to provide food. Some bees are in the nursery, tending the young. The queen is laying eggs. Everything is ideal at the hive. Everything is perfect for the bees.
Except for the outsider, who sees the hive not as a civilization, but as food. A solitary Japanese giant hornet approaches the hive with one goal: mark it for destruction. You see, this is a scout for the hornet colony, and she has one job, and that's to find food. And this is how she does it. She'll mark the beehive with a pheromone so that her sisters can return to this hive and murder every single bee. Understand that these hornets are the Genghis Khan and his Mongol army, few in number, but unbeatable because of their ferocity. 30 hornets can wipe out 30,000 bees in just hours. Genghis would be proud, and after committing that mass murder, the hornets will gather all the thoraxes, larvae, and all the honey they need to feed themselves and their young.
So, the scout sees our hive and plans for war. She approaches to lay the pheromone marker, but notices something strange. There appears to be an unguarded entry point. She's carnivorous, she's hungry. Why not get a little taste?
And this is the most critical moment of the bees' existence. The next few minutes will determine if the bees continue their happy lives or if they'll be wiped off the face of the map. Because the unguarded entry point, that was no accident. It was an elaborate trap that the scout has just fell into.
You see, the bees know their survival depends on the capture of this one scout. They've got to catch this scout. There will be no second chance. Everything depends on a single hornet.
The bees can't give the hornet a chance to return to its nest. If they do, the hornet will return with an insurmountable force, and the bees would face certain death. But this one scout, they just might be able to end it here.
The hornet falls for the trap, enters the interior of the hive, and the bees pounce. No, they're not going to fight the hornet one-on-one. That'd be suicide. They work as a team, a single unit leveraging their numbers to their advantage. They engulf the hornet with their own bodies, up to 500 bees. And then they start to vibrate. They vibrate until the center of the ball, where the hornet is, begins to heat up. More and more bees join the defense and the temperature rises. Up to 117 degrees, that's the sweet spot. Just hot enough to kill the hornet, and just cool enough to spare the bees.
So they won.
They did. And it goes to show, the predators don't always win. And sometimes, predators behave in a way you wouldn't expect. Like a story we'll hear from our guest today, Michael Modjeleski,
who is featured on the Oprah Winfrey Show.
He was Cosmopolitan Magazine's Bachelor of the Year.
Led walking safaris in Tanzania, Africa.
And he's a spokesman for the Alaskan cruise line Princess Cruises.
And today he sits down with us to talk about his book, Inside Passage, Living with Killer Whales, Bald Eagles, and Kwakutl Indians. But first, let's give you a little backstory.
So when Michael was a young man, he decided to test himself by throwing himself directly in the elements, living alone for most of the year on a deserted island in the Inside Passage of Alaska, and learn hard lessons, and he'll describe those in the interview. And it really tested his character and formed who he is today. He's a really interesting guy. I know you guys are going to enjoy this interview, and here it is.
What does it take to survive and thrive in the wilderness where you were?
Well, many people approach it from different angles, and I approached it probably from the worst way you could go into an experience like that. Because Alaska will try to seduce you with beauty, and it will try to kill you in the next moment if you're not prepared. In fact, Jack London wrote that there's 1,000 ways that Alaska can kill a person. I mean, everything from falling overboard, you know, you've got 10 to 20 minutes to live in that icy cold water before hypothermia sets in. A lot of people misjudge distance because the air is so pure. And there's no industry up there in the towns, so there's no particles, there's no pollution in the air whatsoever. And I had to learn to double or triple the distance that my eye was telling my brain for actual distance. Well, because you'd be out in an outboard, you know, you'd be in a dory and you'd have half a tank of gas and you go, oh man, it's blowing 80 out of the southeast. I think I can make it to that shore.